down. Doctor told me if I kept drinking, I was going to die in 6 months. My wife wanted me out of the house. Business partner had just found out I'd been stealing from him for a period of time. Was extremely irritated with that. And he was, an unrecovered Vietnam veteran, but he was not happy with old Tomas, I'll tell you. And so the last thing, we were bankrupt, but we didn't know how to file bankruptcy, or we probably would have done it. We were just too ignorant. But we had an insurance policy because Juanita worked at the state, and in those days insurance would pay for treatment. And so I ran off to hide in a treatment center for a 30-day period. To get down there to stop shaking, I drank a miniature of Stolonaya vodka because it wasn't going to be my last drink. Had I known it was going to be my last drink, it would have been a quart of Jack Daniels, right? Still mad about that 20 years later. But at any rate, I go down there, and a lot of good stuff happened and some kind of crazy stuff happened. I was introduced to what I consider real AA, and I was found by Alcoholics Anonymous. A little meeting came in every morning into this place, and they were there whether the patient showed up or not. They met outside, and they enveloped me. They just, real quickly, the reason I went out there, I knew AA wouldn't work for me. I knew I couldn't live on this planet without drinking. But in this treatment center, it was very progressive for 20 years ago. They boiled all their meat. They had no fat. They served no sugar whatsoever, and there was no caffeine at all. And through the grapevine, I heard that this little group of people that were meeting outside on a patio served coffee with real coffee with caffeine in it. And I thought I'd like some of that. And so I went out onto this patio to drink their coffee. And I'm the only person I've ever met who went to AA for the coffee. It's the God's honest truth. And they were just singing a different song, it seemed. You know, they were telling these crazy stories and just outrageous things and then laughing like crazy about them. You know, it's all the stuff I've been trying to hide and keep under wraps. But at any rate, in the treatment center, the treatment center part itself diagnosed me. And they said, what have you been up to? You know, what tell us about your life. I said, you know, I've been drinking for 16 years, and I've taken a lot of drugs. And they said, well, tell us all about them. And I said, well, I basically drink whiskey for breakfast. If I don't, I can't get to work. I mean, that's my life, and I drink it all day. And when I don't, I start to shake and come apart and oftentimes have blackouts and have beaten my wife severely in a blackout. I broke my arm wrestling a guy one night. And I tell them all the dramatic, crazy, the jails and the hospitals and all the stuff that's happened to me. They say, well, you're alcoholic. You're definitely alcoholic. Well, what else? Well, I've been, importing and distributing cocaine for many years. I like to inject it. I had a heart attack one night. They said, well, you're a cocaine addict. I said, okay. I said, what else? I said, well, I've been, using heroin on and off, mostly on for 10 years. And, I never seemed to get away from it. And I told some, stories about that. And they said, well, you're a heroin addict. And then, anyway, I went through this whole litany of stuff. All the benzodiazepines, the psychedelics, the uppers, the downers, all the painkillers, all the different things I'd taken. And they said, well, you're an addict to this, you're an addict to that, you're, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so I'm just, what do I know? That's what they told me. That's what I go out with. And so I'm going to Cocaine Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and Alcoholics Anonymous, and, calling myself a this, a that, and the other thing. When I met Joe, he told me something that no one else had told me, and he said, it's very, very important. It's vitally important that you know what's wrong with you because you can't recover from something you don't have. People look and they go, they think about that. You know, it's like you can't recover from something you ain't got, right? I mean, that just makes sense. I mean, if you didn't have a medical condition, went to a doctor tell you can't recover from it because you don't have it, you know. There is no recovery from that for you because you don't got it. But that didn't make any sense to me when I first heard it. And he said, well, look at it this way. You're starting a spiritual journey with these steps, aren't you? And I said, yes. He said, you're invested in the truth, aren't you? In rigorous honesty, what we're talking about here. Honesty is different from truth. I won't go into that, but a lot of you know the difference. But he said, rigorous honesty, isn't that what we tout here? And I said, yes, it is. He said, well, if you go into the step process or the spiritual journey with a half-truth or an untruth, how can you expect to have good result from it? I said, well, now you put it that way, I guess you can't. He said, well, what are you powerless over? That's what he asked me. I didn't really understand the question. I said, everything. He said, oh, really? Are you really powerless over everything? I said, oh, yes, I'm powerless over everything. He said, why don't you do something? Why don't you take everything that you think you're powerless over and put it through, start with the doctor's opinion, and put it through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, and here's how you're going to do it. Take the statements that they wrote, okay, the Big Book, most of it was written in 1938. As you know, it came out in April of 39, it was published. They were working on it for at least a year prior. So he said, go through it and take what they wrote in 38 and flip it. And all of the statements that they made, you turn into a personal question for yourself. And where it says we or, they or alcoholics or any of that, you say Tom, I, or me. And try that out. Just personalize it and see what happens. I didn't know at the time that he was tricking me. Okay? I've tricked many since then. Here's the trick. Instead of this dull read that in the treatment center they told me, you can't sleep, well, read the Big Book. You'll go to sleep, right? You ever told that? We might have told somebody that.
It's true.
If it's just a some kind of a dull read that's about other people, it'll put me to sleep. But as soon as I'm in there, it's my autobiography. And the thing I'm the most interested in the world is me. So that it hooked me, okay? It's a dynamic. It actually works. It hooked me. It had me. So I'm in there reading about myself now. And I start putting all this stuff through the Big Book, the Valiums and all the LSD and all this jazz. One thing that really, really surprised me was the cocaine piece, okay? Now, I'm going to explain to you. I don't want to offend anybody by talking about drugs. I'm going to explain in just a minute why I'm doing this, okay? And I think it's very important. I'm a big fifth tradition guy. I don't bring drug addiction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope there's people that have a problem with that, and we can discuss it over the weekend. But I've got to tell you how I established my first step, and that's why I'm doing this, okay? I put the cocaine through. I've got a long, long cocaine history. It started in 1970, and it went until sometime in the late 80s. But the first thing that I got was I couldn't remember the last time I did cocaine. Couldn't remember it. And I told you the last drink I had, I was standing in front of the Barrel House Liquor Store, Santa Fe, sucking down a miniature of vodka. I shot some heroin that morning. I remember that. Last cocaine, I don't remember at all. And I did an awful lot of it. I had a lot of bad experiences with it. So that got my attention. Why can't I remember it? And then I started to substitute cocaine for alcohol in the Big Book. And what I came up with was I got to a point with cocaine where the going up was not worth the coming down. The depression I felt from doing it was not worth the high that I got. And literally, I would turn down free coke. I'd say, no, you got any heroin to go with that? Oh, you don't? No, thank you. Okay. Now, here's the fifth tradition part. I try to sit down with a crackhead and work with a crackhead, right? And he's going, oh, and then I do coke all night. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'm right with you. And then I'd go out and steal something and stuff. And I'm thinking, well, I didn't steal too much to get it. And he says, what's your experience? And I say, well, I just got to a point where I didn't want to do it anymore. The going up wasn't worth the coming down. And his eyes glass over, okay? He experienced the same depression I did. But there's something different with him where he would go back to it, and what he got out of it overrode the part that said, don't do it. It's not worth it. With me, the depression part overrode the high. You understand? And so we don't have a common language. He doesn't understand what I'm talking about. We got to a point where I said, no, that's the end of that deal, to free cocaine, and he just doesn't understand that, okay? Beyond that, they didn't have crack when I sobered up, so I never had the experience. As far as I'm concerned, you shoot cocaine. That's what you do. But as far as he's concerned, you smoke crack. So it's a different kind of a deal. Okay, so lo and behold, I find out I've been going to CA meetings calling myself a cocaine addict. I'm not. Why am I not a cocaine addict? Because I can choose whether I do it or not. Okay? Does not mean that I could go out here and smoke some crack with some joker with impunity and do that. It would derail me from the spiritual path I'm on. Okay? But the thing is, I can exercise my power of choice where cocaine is concerned, and I choose not to do that. Okay? Now, that same choice I made with booze and with heroin hundreds of times. I chose not to and then did. Okay? I drink when I don't want to drink. If you can relate to that, you know what I'm talking about, okay? I set out. I've got every conviction in the world. Today I'm not going to do it. I tell my wife. She believes me. Everybody's happy. And 2 hours later I'm drinking, and I'm the most surprised one, okay? I say I will never do that damn heroin again, no matter what. You know, I'm not going to associate with those murderers and those people that I'm always running with and stuff. It's not going to happen anymore. And 3 days later, I forget my strong conviction. My mind says, you've been working real hard at your job. You've been clean for 3 days. You ought to reward yourself, you know, and I'm back at the Connects. So, and the Valiums and all that stuff was stuff that I used to enhance my experience with these other things, okay? I designed that experience. I chose to do that or not to do it, you know. Being addicted to LSD is a little, I know I've met people who said they were, I don't quite understand that. It's that's spooky to me. But anyway, so, but out of this, well, the point I'm trying to make is out of all of this, I got my truth, okay? I'm a real alcoholic. I am a real alcoholic. No matter how much information I am given about myself, no matter how well I understand that the first drink always leads to some horrible scene in my life, you know, and will ultimately destroy me, I can't use that information to keep me from picking up that drink, okay? Because that worm starts turning, you know, the stuff starts happening, and at this time it's going to be different, and it's been like that 1,000 times with me. I've lost the power to choose whether I drink or don't choose, and I never got it back sober either. That's interesting. I hear people say today, I choose not to drink. And I think, well, if you can choose not to drink, if you have that power, then you're not my kind of alcoholic. Because I lost that power to choose. And I'll tell you, if there's time this weekend, I'll tell you a very interesting story about that. So I'm a real alcoholic. I'm a hope-to-die heroin addict. I will never get off either of those two things through my own power, volitional power. It ain't going to happen. One of the really neat things that happened to me through recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous is I don't do heroin anymore. I don't shoot heroin. I hadn't for 20 years, okay? I don't cheat on my wife. I don't gamble very much. It's gotten a lot better. There's a lot of things. I don't. God bless you. I don't lie, generally. I generally tell the truth. And that's just, you know, because making amends for lying is so humiliating. After a while, you just hopefully stop doing it, you know. But so a lot of things have come along with working a spiritual program that I work in Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm powerless over alcohol. But I don't bring those things specifically to AA. I can't stand up at a podium for an hour and talk and not tell you about heroin in my story because it's one of the things I tried to use to get off of booze. It did not work, okay? But I also tried to use antabuse, and I'll tell you about that. But I don't dwell on drugs in AA, okay? Some people say it's all the same thing. A drug is a drug is a drug. I don't know what kind of Jack Daniels and what kind of heroin you were using, but to me they were very, very different experiences. I had two completely different sets of people that I ran with. You know, very rarely would the twain meet. Because I drank and shot dope, I was an outcast in every group. No one wanted to hang out with me. You know, the drinkers didn't trust me because I was sticking needles in my arm. And most heroin addicts don't drink whiskey right after they get high. But I do, okay? So anyway, I was kind of a social outcast in every society. But the point of all of that is that I think it's extremely important that you know what's wrong with you, okay? If you want to try that, if you never have, I suggest it as a real good exercise. Be invested in the truth, okay? The truth will set you free. Juanita, she was working with a gal who'd been 11 years in AA, a gal named Kim who lives in Santa Fe. I sponsor her husband. And Kim was in AA and called herself an alcoholic because she had gone to a treatment center where they told her, you're an alcoholic. She was 17 years old. She'd been doing some coke. And she went into a treatment center and they said, well, a drug addict and alcoholic is all the same, so go to AA and say you're an alcoholic. And so she did. I don't think she'd been drunk 3 times in her life. But for 11 years, she was in AA and trying to do AA, and something just wasn't clicking. And she started working with Juanita, and she went through the big book, and she got to the point where the truth about what was wrong with her was much more important to her than some phony sobriety date. And so she tried, if you know what the Marty Mann test, or what we call it, it's not really what it is, but you try some controlled drinking, like two drinks a day, no more, no less, for 30 days, or something akin to that. Read the, if you really want to do it, read The Primer on Alcoholism by Marty Mann, and she lays it out. But you try some controlled drinking, like the big book says. And Kim just got tired, I think, wasn't it?
She got pregnant.
She got pregnant and stopped. But she had gotten her truth long before that. And what happened, this is the interesting thing that happened to her. She left AA, but she got into Al-Anon big time. And she's an extremely effective member of Al-Anon, okay, because she's not in the wrong fellowship any longer. And she's her life took new meaning. It took off when she found that truth. One other story, the story of Laura, and I hope this illustrates something. I tell this all over. There was a neat gal that went to the friendship club that Juanita was talking about. She went to AA meetings. I'd heard her speak, and she was, Laura always talked about heroin. She was a heroin addict is what she was. But she liked AA better, you know. You hear this a lot. Oh, well, the AA is better than the NA, you know, and da-da-da-da. I mean, I hear this coast to coast. The point is, you know, I think with that is that we members of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's requisite on us to help people in NA and CA to make their programs stronger, you know, and help them out. At any rate, this Laura was going to AA meetings, and she would slip, like, every once in a while. And I thought, you're a heroin addict. You need to sit down with her and talk to her. But she's a woman, right? She was an attractive woman. And she was in her early 40s, and I thought, nah, don't go there. You know, it's like, just that's not your business. Let her work that out with somebody else, and et cetera, et cetera. And so I never said anything to her. I never said, Laura, you might be in the wrong fellowship. You might be in the wrong fellowship because you're not in the place where the people have what you have so that you can reach out and help somebody else who has what you have, which is how we save our own asses here, right? And I never did. I never said a word to her. I just let it slide. They found Laura in a parking lot in Santa Fe with a needle in her arm, dead as could be, leaving three children. And Tom never said anything because he didn't want to cross that boundary with a woman. And to my great shame, that happened. And I tell you, I will never, ever let that happen again. Okay? I care more about you. I love you more than I care about your feelings. Okay? And saving your life is more important to me than whether you like me or not. Absolutely it is. But it took that dramatic a thing happening. And I hope that helps somebody. I hope Laura's story will help somebody. An alcoholic is someone who drinks too much. They're someone who has a problem with alcohol. They've lost the ability to choose whether they can drink or whether they can't. And it just, I've lost the ability of choice to take the first drink. And I've lost the ability of choice to take the second drink, okay? And it's just as simple as that. We'll read all sorts of stuff, doctor's opinion, Bill's story, more about alcoholism. It's all going to boil down to that again and again. If you don't have that, if you don't lose control over the amount once you first start drinking, okay, but you're drinking for some psychological reason, what did Big Frank used to call it, emotional or situational drinking, okay, then you might want to look at it. Am I an alcoholic, you know, as described in this book? It's certainly worth looking at, you know. And if you care about the truth, then you'll do that. You want to hit it?
I'll tell you a couple little stories. When I got my current sponsor, there's a story she used to tell about when she got her big book. And it goes like this. She went to this guy after being in Alcoholics Anonymous a few weeks, and she said, the woman who brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous said, I have to have a big book, that the way we recover is in the big book, and so I want a big book. And you were talking about the big book, and you've got the big book, so I want to buy one. And he said, okay. He said, I'll sell you a big book, but first of all, I'm going to tell you a little story. And so he told her the story of when he had about a year in Alcoholics Anonymous. He went to this guy, Larry, and Larry had some time, and Larry was, you know, he was a big shot in Alcoholics Anonymous out in California. And so Hugh goes to Larry and says, Larry, I want to talk to you about this big book. And Larry says, okay, what do you want to talk to me about? Well, Hugh had thought he found some loopholes in this book. And so he wanted to chat with Larry a little bit. And Larry said, you know what, I'll talk with you. But I'll talk to you when you can tell me what's on the first page of that book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So Larry went home and he memorized, you know, the preface. So he memorized the preface and comes back about 3 months later and says, begins to recite the preface. And Larry says, what are you doing? He said, well, you told me that you'd talk to me about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous if I could tell you what's on the first page. He said, well, that's not on the first page. Go on, get out of here. So he goes back home and, you know, he memorizes the table of contents and comes back to Larry. And Larry says, that's not it. Go on home. So he, you know, goes back one more time and finally he reads and he memorizes the page, Alcoholics Anonymous, a story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. He says, that's it. He goes back to him and Larry says, oh, go home. I don't want to talk to you. Finally he says, ah, okay, the first page. Alcoholics Anonymous, just Alcoholics Anonymous on the page. So he goes and he, you know, says that to Larry, and Larry says, that's not it. Can I borrow your book?
Yeah.
Please, babe. And Larry says, that's not it. Give me that book. And so he grabs the book from Hugh, and he said, there is nothing on the first page of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And if it has taken you this long and you still couldn't figure it out, how long do you think it's going to take you to figure out what's in the black lines of this book? So, I know there's a lot of you who have been through the steps many, many times and probably know this book a lot better than I do, and I know it pretty damn good, I'll tell you. But is this as far as God can take you? Is this it? Is this it? When I sat down one day in morning prayer and meditation, I realized it was time to go through the steps again because I realized I was powerless over what was going on with my father, with his illness. He had prostate cancer that had metastasized in the lungs and in the bones, and I started to put it through the first step. I thought, God's brought me a heck of a long ways. My life is good. My life is really good. My relationships with Tom is good. My relationships with all members of my family was good, really good. Not just kind of good, but really good. I was in a good place. I felt good. But I was having difficulty watching my father go through this and the pain that it was causing me and seeing the pain it was causing him. And my mother. My mother, still an unrecovered member, an unrecovered family member, 80 years old and unrecovered with the disease of alcoholism, the family disease of alcoholism. And so I said, I need more. So my question to you is, have you gone as far as you can possibly go, or is there more? Is there more? Because for me, there's always more. Just like the title of the chapter, More on Alcoholism, there's always more. So, a little more about Hugh. About 5 years ago, I was speaking at a conference in Laughlin, Nevada. I shared my story, got done, was thanked by people, but I didn't feel quite right. And I thought, what is wrong? There's nothing wrong with my story. I did a great job sharing my story. You know, I felt good about it, but I didn't feel quite right deep within. And I thought, what is up? So I made a mistake that I make every once in a while, and I said a prayer. And I said, God, what is wrong? Why is it that even though my sharing was good, I don't feel right? I don't feel like I was connected with the people who were in that room. Well, this book tells me that, in fact, this book promises me that if I ask and I really want the answer, I will get it. And guess what? I got the answer. And what I got was, you need to work these steps. You need to work these steps. So I promptly did, 6 months later. I was sitting up at the conference in Colorado that is my I consider my home conference. It was a Saturday night. And I was sitting out there in the audience waiting for the Saturday night speaker to begin. And all of a sudden, in a room full of people, a noisy room, bright lights, I find myself in a very dark place. It was dark. I'm not talking a bad place, but it was a dark place. It was dark and it was quiet. And I was alone. And I can't tell you how long that lasted, but when I came out of it, the thought that came to me was, if you do not work these steps again, you will die. You will die. Physical death doesn't matter. Emotional death doesn't matter. But definitely was a spiritual death that I was coming to if I didn't get to working these steps one more time. So I did. I began immediately. Well, I went through that set of steps, and then I found myself, I guess it was January down in Midland in 05, I was sharing my story one more time, and I found myself towards the end, I'm almost done, getting this thought of something I needed to share with the people as I was telling my story, and I thought, no, I don't think so. We're not going there. And when I was done, I also realized that I didn't feel that connection one more time with the people who were sitting in the audience. And I said, okay, what's up with that? Not only what's up with that, but I realized that I had denied God. I said no. I was given an intuitive thought of something to share, and I said, no, we're not going there. So not only was I not feeling connected, but I said no to God. And I said, what's going on? And I remembered an amends I hadn't made. It was an old amends. So we went up to Denver, and this was January, mid-January, and about 3 weeks later we're up in Denver, and I sat with Don. And I was telling Don this story, and I said, Don, I found an amends that's a very, very old amends that I need to make. And he said to me what I knew, you know, but we can't see our own stuff. He said to me exactly what I know I've said to many people who I work with, who come to me. And he said, if there's something between you and another person, there's something between you and God. He said, you better go make that amends. So I did. So this brings me back to the story of Hugh. Hugh, who was my grand sponsor, Mary Thayer's sponsor, he was one, Hugh and Beverly, Hugh received a letter from a woman who absolutely loved him and who he loved. This woman was a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Hugh had 9 years. And in this letter this woman wrote, she said, Hugh, I love you, and I'm concerned about you, and I'm concerned about your sobriety. She said, you have become like the old golf pro. You know how to teach the game, but you don't play anymore. You know how to teach the game, but you don't play anymore. If I'm not actively in the steps, I can become like the old golf pro. Hugh went out. 9 years of sobriety, and Hugh went out. He came back. He died with
27.
Yeah, 20-some years of sobriety, 27, I think, and went on to help a lot of people. But that story reminds me of when I was in Laughlin. It took me 6 months to begin to work the steps again, and I could have died. I could have died. See, what I found out for myself is not only alcoholism a deadly disease for the alcoholic, but it's a deadly disease for the families as well. I am not so much suicidal, but I am homicidal. I will take your ass out before I take mine out. But either way, it's a deadly disease.
Well, thanks a lot. What was that amends?
Okay, he wants me to tell it. We'd been married maybe 4 years. I was working at a medical center, and he liked to do a little heroin, as he told you. And there was a box of syringes that I thought he would really love me if I took him home to him. So I took him home to him. You know, always trying to please your man. And he wasn't as thrilled as I thought he would be, actually. I think I brought it a little close to home for him. But I needed to make amends for that box of syringes that I'd stolen. So I did go home, and I made amends. I paid them way more than the syringes were worth to them, but not more than they were worth to me.
Yeah, she's not kidding about the homicidal part either. If it doesn't come out this weekend, you can ask her about the time she nearly drowned me in the bathtub when I was passed out there. That's a good story, cute story. Okay. Rolling right along. I'm in the doctor's opinion. Actually, no. Hang on. Sorry. It's getting late and I jumped. This is a piece that we like to point out. We are all over the place tonight, I'll tell you. Okay, I had a favorite big book. It was a third edition. I got it when I got sober, right? My old big book with all marked up and this, that, and the other thing. And I was with a good buddy of mine, J.S., from Redondo Beach, California. If you ever have a chance to hear him speak or get his he does a workshop on the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. He calls it the Akron Genesis of AA. And we were up talking, you know, sometimes a couple of guys get together who have heard of each other or have talked on the phone, and, you know, you're both really excited about Alcoholics Anonymous and this journey. We stayed up till 3 in the morning just talking, he and I. And at one point he said, Tom, what big book do you use? And I said, oh, well, you know, I've got my third edition, my old trusty third edition. That he said, you know, all the newcomers are using this one. It never occurred to me, you know. I go out to the penitentiary, I do a workshop, and we're fumbling around in the Roman numerals because they don't add up anymore, right? But out of my self-centeredness, I'm going to use my old third big book, you know. So I changed. I use a fourth edition now. So in the fourth edition on XX, which is the coin I got last month, had XX on it. Dos Equis. I really like that. That was. It says, while the internal difficulties of our adolescent period were being ironed out, public acceptance of AA grew by leaps and bounds. For this, there were two principal reasons. One, the large number of recoveries and reunited homes. And Juanita and I always talk about the fact that although we do see recoveries quite often, we don't see reunited homes as much as we think they used to. And hopefully, you know, by doing this work, we're going to be a force for that. That's what we hope. We, against all odds, we've been married the 19th of this month. We've been married 28 years. We've been together for 29 years. And there's no way that we should be together. I mean, everything, you know, if you add it all up, we're as different as night and day. We're just, everything about us is different. And the horrible 9 years that we had where she nearly killed me, I nearly beat her. I mean, it's just awful, grim stuff. You know, there's no way you ought to be able to surmount that, and yet we have. And people always ask us, how have you stayed together? I mean, how has that worked for you? And I always tell them that it's the 10th step is the probably the single most important piece that we're telling each other constantly. I was wrong to do that. You know, I was wrong. You didn't deserve that. That's when we throw in. I hadn't found that in the book, but it sounds good. You know, I was wrong to do that, and I regret it. And God willing, I won't do it again. You know, and those golden words, "I was wrong," have helped tremendously. And beyond that, we have a common purpose. You know, we have unity in our family group. You know, that we're out to help alcoholics and their families, and we do it together. And that common purpose has helped us to stay together. We'll talk about more of that during the weekend. Okay, on page XXII, the very bottom of the forward to the third edition, it says, in spite of the great increase in the size and span of this fellowship, at its core it remains simple and personal. Each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. And that's the way we do it. I mean, we do these workshops. We do a lot of different things. But when you get right down to it, it's one alky talking to another. I think it's one alky reading this book to another is what it amounts to. You know, one of the dynamics I was taught by Don and Joe and a lot of these people was that Don always used to say, problem with alcoholics is they can't read. He said, I don't mean they're illiterate. I mean, they just can't read. They read a sentence and it's not what's written there. And so after I instruct someone to go through the book and to turn the statements into questions for themselves, then I sit and I'll read it back to them. Excuse me. Invariably, they hear it completely differently than they did when it was rattling in their head. And so I really believe in that dynamic of reading the book. I read the entire big book, the doctor's opinion in 164 pages, to another alcoholic. And we go through it that way and try to follow the directions. Okay, now we're to the doctor's opinion. 25 in Roman numerals, XXV, very bottom of the page. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. Am I of the type with whom other methods failed completely? Absolutely, I am. So what I did was I put a big plus right after absolutely. I agree with that. That's been my experience. Okay, next page. Down here it says, in this statement, he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. So I stop the guy and I say, have you suffered alcoholic torture? Now, that's different for everybody, but I have certainly suffered alcoholic torture, and I could tell you about it ad nauseum. We must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. Okay, I didn't get that. When I first read that, I didn't understand what that meant. What do you mean? My body is as abnormal as my mind. I overdrink, okay, because I overdrink, and let me tell you why I overdrink. I have a lot of problems. I've had an extremely difficult life. My childhood was less than great, okay? And then I basically never caught a break, you know. It was, you know, the SOBs coming at me from every direction, nobody cutting me any slack, you know, ex-wives, girlfriends, my children don't appreciate me, you know, on and on and on. And if you had my kind of life, you'd drink too, okay? And so I drink, and because that's medicine, I overdrink, and you know, I drink for psychological reasons. That's why I drink, okay? And you go, really? The guy said to me, really? You know, let's look at that, okay? Did you ever... you know, and of course you all have heard this, most of you. Did you ever drink because you were feeling really funky and you know, just the anxiety and the angst were upon you? Oh, did I ever, 100 times. Did you ever drink actually because you were celebrating something good happened in your life? Well, as a matter of fact, I did. Yes, now that you pointed out. How about this kind of drinking? There ain't nothing happening. You're bored senseless, and let's drink and get something going. Done that too. Okay, so that kind of, you know, squashes the psychological aspect. But the thing that they got into with me was, did you ever go out to drink and take a couple of drinks and you start to feel pretty good, you're not feeling all that angst, and you have celebrated, and things aren't dull or anything, okay? And you get to where you say you want to go, and then you keep drinking. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, that brings up a time that I can remember very well. It was April 15th. Somebody said my sobriety date was on or about April 15th. Of course, it's tax day, right? Juanita says, I don't care what you do, but be home by midnight because we got to sign off on our taxes. Honey, don't worry. I'll be home by midnight. Okay, fully intend to. I've been drinking. I start drinking with some guys after work. Actually, the guy who was paying us, you know, brought out some whiskey, and we started drinking. And that's the last thing I remember. Next thing I remember, I'm stumbling up the steps. It's 1:30 in the morning, and I'm going, oh, my God, how could I have done that? How could I have missed the deadline? Well, I was told about that episode by the people who were cognizant of what was going on, okay? They said I did all sorts of, I peed in the fireplace and drove home, you know, just awful stuff. Long drive home, and I was all over the road, and a guy was following me, and it was just a horrible, disastrous, you know, typical evening. But when I looked at that sober, something happened to me, and it was this. I claimed that I wanted oblivion, that I drank for oblivion. I drank for relief that oblivion gave me. I just want out of here. I'm chicken to kill myself. I'm afraid of where I'll go if I do. But I can't stand to be here and be conscious of what's going on. Man's intolerance to man and just the horrible suffering on this planet. I'm a sensitive guy, and I just can't take it.
They're right with you, honey.
And I drank for oblivion, okay? And what happened was, when I remembered that night, what I saw was a guy who was drinking, maybe he was drinking for oblivion, I don't know, but I hit oblivion. I hit oblivion and then drank a fifth of whiskey, oblivious to the fact that I was doing it. You know what I'm saying? My mind's not drinking at that point. We don't care what kind of an upbringing I had, what my parents were like, or what kind of deep-seated psychological problems I have after I'm oblivious and I'm still tipping that bottle. Something else is drinking, and it's not my normal function, okay? And that's when I got the physical part of my disease. I drink in a way that most people don't, okay? I drink in a way that when something clicks inside me, I lose control and I keep drinking. And that's what they're talking about. That's the deal. You want to talk about Al-Anons and the physical?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the allergy that the doctor talks about on that same page. It says, the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. Well, the first time I went through the steps, I was like, well, that doesn't apply to me as a family member. I can certainly see how it applies to an alcoholic. And as an Al-Anon, I take what's in here, and every time it talks about alcohol or drinking, I put in thinking. I put in my thinking. I'm powerless over my thinking. And for those of you who are alcoholic, there's a place later on in the book where it says we have now, we have solved the drink problem. Now we're faced with the problem of living. So if there are those of you who have solved the drink problem, God has solved the drink problem, this book also says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in their mind. So if the main problem centers in your mind, you might want to consider putting your thinking through this book, just like I would as a family member, okay? So that's what I do. Well, I heard a friend of mine talk about, he was talking about the first step, and he said, you know, an alcoholic can say, my name is so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic, and you get it. I mean, you get it. But when I introduce myself and I say, my name's so-and-so, and I'm an Al-Anon, it's like, well, what does that mean? And he started to talk about what happened to him with somebody's drinking. And I started thinking a little bit more. And the next time I went through the steps, I began to pay a little more attention to this allergy. And, you know, this thing that we say a prayer, I say a prayer when I start the steps anew, which is I ask God for a new experience, an open heart, mind, and spirit, a new experience. I got a new experience. When I saw the word allergy, I thought back to the days when Tom would come home and he'd walk in with a six-pack, he'd walk in with a bottle of wine, or he would come in just completely loaded. And I remembered what happened to me. And what would happen to me, the physical factor that would happen to me was this. He'd walk in, he'd be loaded, and immediately my gut would feel like a wet washcloth that somebody was trying to wring out. It was as if though somebody were just taking my insides and just wringing them. They were just like knotted and just being crunched together. And that feeling would go all the way to my back, and my spine would begin to stiffen. My shoulders would stiffen. My arms would tighten at my sides, and my hands would immediately turn into fists, and my jaw would do this. What is an allergy? I got bitten by a bee many, many years ago on my little finger. I still have a little scar from it. My entire arm swelled up and became very red all the way up to my shoulder. That's an allergy. An allergy is an abnormal physical reaction. I had an abnormal physical reaction to bee venom. My arm swelled up and it got red. I had an abnormal physical reaction to alcohol, and I didn't even have to drink it. It was a physical reaction that would begin in my belly, go to my back, up my spine, and my entire body would do this. I didn't even have to drink it. And I would have an abnormal physical reaction. And to me, as a family member, that's an allergy. I was taught that it's a three-part disease. It affects me body, mind, and spirit. That's my body. That's my body. The doctor's going to talk about the mind, and as a family member, that's the obsession. That's the obsession. I cannot stop thinking about him and what he's going to do, how much he's going to drink, what he did, what I know he won't do, and how is he going to affect me? How can I make him not drink so that I won't be affected? So I won't be affected. Now, it's not to say I didn't love him, although I wasn't quite sure at the time many times, you know, but it was like, how was I going to get him to do what I wanted him to do? Another way the body for me as a family member is affected is I would make sure he'd go to the doctor. I'd make sure my children would go to the doctor, but I wouldn't go to the doctor. I would not take care of myself at all. He came first, my kids, and I came in somewhere down the road. And that's the body for me, and that's the allergy.
Okay. So going on with this idea of the, we're still on XXVI. It did not satisfy us to be told we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life. I was maladjusted to life. They told me that at an early age. First psychiatrist when I was 17 years old. We're in full flight from reality. I was told that all my life. Or we're an outright mental defective, and I've been called that for years and years. So I might qualify for all three of those. It says these things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. And I am sure, because when I drink, something happens that is beyond all of that, like I told you. But here's an interesting statement here that he makes. He says, in our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. Okay? And how I read that is if you don't have that physical, that allergy, that phenomenon of craving which develops, then you don't have alcoholism. You know, you may have something else, but it isn't alcoholism as described in this book. Let's see. I'm going to throw this in. This just hit me. I don't know why I'm even bringing this up. We 20 years ago, we used to go to a lot of meetings in West Texas, in Amarillo and Lubbock and places like that. And you'd invariably hear these old-timers who were like dissing hospitals for alcoholics, you know. And they'd go, well, in the old days, you know, we just get some honey and orange juice and put them on the, you know, take them into the bedroom and put them in there and just feed them honey and orange juice and they'd shake it out in a few days. And, you know, that's the way we did it. We didn't have all these fancy hospitals and all this. And I thought, well, that sounds good. I guess that's the way I ought to be doing 12 steps. Till I read in the doctor's opinion, it says, though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it's imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he then has a better chance of understanding, accepting what we have to offer. I've heard too many stories of people having seizures and dying on people's couches to believe that that's a good way to do it. But the bottom line is, it doesn't matter what I believe. The big book says that's what AA believes, okay? Down at the bottom of the next page, it says, of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be a maximum benefit. And then Bill says in his story, treatment seem wise for the delirium tremens were going to happen, basically, you know. So three times I read in the big book that we believe in hospitalization because, you know, we're not just nut jobs or having a bad day. We have a physical illness that needs treatment. You want to say something?
No.
Okay. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics, manifestation of an allergy, phenomenon of craving is, listen to this, is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. I'm always working with guys, and I say, do you lose control over the amount of booze that you drink once you start drinking? And they'll sit there for a second, and they'll go, not always, right? Not always. I say, that's not what I asked you. Does that ever happen to you? Have you experienced this? Oh, yes, many times. And I said, well, then one thing we know about you is you ain't an average temperate drinker, based on what this book says, okay? Because it says it never happens in the average temperate drinker, okay? We don't know if you're alky yet, but we know you're not an average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit, they found they cannot break it. Once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, this is that sentence we love, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Tell you a quick story, just because I like to tell it. It's totally irrelevant, but no, it's not. It's not irrelevant. I read this, you know, and I was going through this with a fine-tooth comb. I didn't want to miss anything. I'd almost missed AA, so I tried to do this, dot every I, cross every T. I was anal retentive about doing exactly what the big book said. And I'm reading this, and it says that these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And what I immediately thought was, I know I've taken these, I have a liver condition, and I take, I can't remember what it is I take for it. Yeah, well, it's a tincture. It's milk thistle. And for a few years, I had taken this tincture, and I read on it that it had grain alcohol in it, okay? But I'd taken it, and I didn't know any better. And so as soon as I saw it had grain alcohol in it, I stopped taking it. And I thought, you know, that's interesting because I did take it and I didn't get drunk. What's up with that? Okay. And some years later, after, you know, and so I debated that. And what I came up with was it's not safe for a guy like me to do that. That's what the book says. I can't safely do it. Okay. It doesn't say that, you know, God won't protect me at certain times, but that's not a really good idea for a guy like me. So I'm up at the health food store, and I'm buying this milk thistle, and I'm explaining to the gal there, I want the milk thistle that's a tincture with glycerin, not grain alcohol. I can't do any alcohol. She looks through the shelves, and she looks for a while. She says, sir, you know, they all have grain alcohol in them, but, sir, there's no more alcohol in one of these tinctures than there is in a ripe banana. And I never thought this. I did not plan this. What popped out of my mouth was, it's funny you said that, because when I eat a really ripe banana, it makes me want to drink Jack Daniels. And she looked at me like another head had grown out of my neck, you know. And I said, oh, that's okay. Don't worry. I'm sorry, you know. She doesn't need that information, but I do. And alcoholics need that information. Get what I'm saying? It's just a simpleton little thing. It's not probably not at all important, but I don't go near alcohol. I don't gargle with Listerine. I don't do any of those things. Why? It's not safe. Maybe I could. I don't want to chance it. There's no reason to do that. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcohol people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. And this is a very important piece. My home group just dwells on this, I'll tell you. The question is, what do you mean by frothy emotional appeal? What the hell does that mean? And it was Joe and other people who said to me, did you ever have anybody come to you and beg you to stop drinking? I said, oh, my God. I said, Juanita would beg me. She'd say, I can't stand to see you killing yourself. You got to leave. He said, well, that's frothy emotional appeal. How about like a doctor or the courts? I said, oh, my God. I said, my doctor, Trevor Hawkins, who I love in Santa Fe and just respect so much, he said, Tom, he said, if you keep drinking the way you are, you're going to die in 6 months. You're 37 years old, and you're going to be dead in 6 months, and I can't stand to watch it. That's frothy emotional appeal. I mean, that really is. A doctor who likes you and is your friend says you're going to die in 6 months, I tell you, I went right to the liquor store because that made me nervous as hell to hear that. You got to have a drink. What do you do with information like that? You got to have a drink, right? But that's frothy emotional appeal. And then Judge Cuate Chavez, okay, he tells me, I came before him. He says, Tom, you ever come before me with one of these drunken charges again, I'm going to put you under the penitentiary. We'll throw the key away. You're going to jail big time, okay? Frothy emotional. I don't want to go to prison. I know what happens in prison. You know, I don't want to go there. Frothy emotional appeal. But I leave and I'm drunk that night, okay? Drunk that night, not intending to be. I used to give myself little pep talks. I'd be driving to work. It's a 20-mile drive from my house to Santa Fe. And I'd say to myself, Tom, you're too good to live this way. You're killing yourself. You're destroying yourself. Come on, you were raised better than this. You know, you shouldn't be doing this. You can do better. Today you're not going to drink. Today you're going to, and I'm feeling pumped up. I'm feeling great. And my truck drives itself to the drive-up liquor window. For some bizarre reason, I'm there to buy a pack of cigarettes. So I figure, well, how could a couple of shooters hurt? I'll stop tomorrow, you know. And the one that got me was I remembered my little son, 6 years old. He's now 34. He's out here in Huntington out here. We're going to visit him and stay with him for 4 days after we're done here. He's 6 years old, and we're standing in front of Cliff's Liquors in Santa Fe. And I've got a miniature of vodka. And he's saying, Dad, you don't have to drink that. You don't need that, Dad. Please don't drink that. You don't have to drink that, Dad. And I'm seeing a movie of myself drinking that thing. His heart's breaking. My heart's breaking. There's nothing I can do about it. Frothy emotional appeal doesn't suffice for a guy like me. You can't scare me into it, okay? You can't bully me into it. You can't intimidate me, and you can't break my heart into it. There's not a way you can do it. It's got to be something else.
So, it's 9:50, and I'm sure you all are tired, and I'm kind of tired. I think time's a little... You're a little tired?
Huh?
Are you a little tired? Actually, he could probably go
up.
No,
I'm not tired. Let's go to 11:30. What do you say? No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
So, we need to know what time you all want to start up tomorrow morning.
We need a group conscience.
Somebody says 10, 9.
10?
9.
No.
Okay. Yeah.
Hold on. Ed made a very important point. Are we talking about breakfast, Bart? What time for breakfast?
8 o'clock.
The locals are shouting 8 o'clock. What's the deal? What's the consensus?
9. 9?
For breakfast.
8
o'clock breakfast?
Yes.
8 o'clock breakfast, 9 o'clock we start here.
Yes.
Be there, be square.
All right, thank you for your attention and your time.